Okay, this is Back to School Night 2016 speech. If you're familiar with the Oscar-winning movie The King's Speech, you'll recall that it's the story of King George VI of England, otherwise known as Bertie, and his struggle to overcome a terrible stammer while reluctantly taking the throne after his elder brother abdicates so that he can lead the country through a difficult period of World War II by giving speeches that unite the country and give them courage in a time of fear. According to the movie, many therapists tried to treat the King's stammer reductionistically, thinking it a physical and mechanical ailment of some sort. Therefore, they treat it with mechanistic and physical answers, such as practicing speaking with marbles in his mouth. Others, like his father, see Bertie's problem as one of mere education or knowledge, which is reductionistic as well, and so he insists Bertie must not know how, and commands him to enunciate, Bertie. It's easy when you know how, as if it were all about knowing. In desperation, after the failure of all of these approaches, Bertie's wife, Elizabeth, makes her way to a seedy part of town to meet an unconventional elocution coach, Lionel, who at first seems to be offering mere quackery. But this apparent quack asks some very perceptive questions. What is your first memory? When did the defect begin? And in doing so, he's getting at the heart of Bertie's story, both psychological and bodily. And it is here that we find the intersection of body and actions, mind and story. Lionel is getting down to the bottom of the narrative that is tying up Bertie's tongue. Long story short, it turns out that re-narration is the only way to fix the stutter, to find his voice. And so in re-narrating Bertie's life story, what Lionel calls not carrying his father around in his pocket, Lionel helps to connect Bertie's body and actions with a new story that helps him to eventually overcome his stammer to speak to and lead the country at a critical time. What I love about this particular movie and story is that in our often flat and Cartesian, reductionistic world, this exemplifies the power of story to not only inform our reason and intellect, but simultaneously stir our moral imagination and kindle our affections with visions of what could be and would be and should be, a sense of oughtness, in such a way that we then act differently because of those two things. It links knowing, desiring, and doing together and connects what some have called the longest foot in the world from head to heart and also from heart to hands. As I'm sure you all know, classical Christian education has never been about merely informing students, reducing education to information dissemination, though that view would certainly make our job as educators far easier than it is. While ideas do have consequences and what you know is indeed important, as you all know from experience, knowing something and even believing something doesn't necessarily mean that you will act accordingly. This is why you can know all sorts of things about the benefits of exercise and believe in how good it is for you, but still be a couch potato. It's why you can know about and believe in eating raw and processed foods and in sustainable farming practices, and yet find yourself wolfing down a hot dog at the Costco food court. Because at the end of the day, what we know and even believe doesn't always drive us to action. But what will drive us to action is what we have come to love, what we have come to desire. For while we are rational and believing beings, we are perhaps first and foremost desiring beings. That's why people often love before they think. They imagine before they theorize. They often worship before they understand the abstractions of doctrine and canon, if they ever do. So while knowing and believing things rightly is very important, it is just as important to desire rightly, to like and dislike what one ought to love what God loves and to hate what God hates, to have rightly ordered affections, as Augustine would say, because that is what often drives our actions. And what we desire and love is often powerfully shaped by stories. We humans are made for story, and Christians in particular are people of a story, capital S, creation, fall, redemption, and glorification. More than propositional truths consciously and rationally chosen, most of us are wooed to a particular vision of the good life by stories that have captured our imagination for good or ill. And those stories shape our desires, which in turn shape our actions. Why else do you think Jesus spoke in parables instead of theological treatises? Why did Nathan confront King David's adultery with Bathsheba with a story? Why is it that you can't remember the last theory you heard in a lecture, but can remember the stories used to illustrate the theory? Why is it that literature can often woo someone to a certain truths or points of views in a way that philosophical treatises may not? Why have fables and fairy tales been passed down for so long? And why do biographies remain such a popular genre that inspires people to become Olympic athletes and teachers and businessmen and missionaries? Why is it when you discipline a child with a litany of their crimes and misdemeanors, all they really hear is wah, 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 like Charlie Brown's teacher? But when you tell them a story in the midst of their discipline, suddenly you have their attention and, more importantly, their hearts. Because stories have the power to engage not only our intellect and reason with truth, but to train our affections and kindle our desires in such a way as to propel us to action. They can integrate what you know, what you love, and what you actually do, knowledge, affections, and action. And how many other things can do that as well? If you've read our mission statement, you'll realize that that is exactly what we seek to do here at Cambridge, to link knowing, loving, and doing together, training the intellect by helping students to know and recognize what is true, good, and beautiful, training the affections by actually leading them to love what they know to be true, good, and beautiful, and then training their actions until they become part of their muscle memory and have been habituated till they actually practice what is true, good, and beautiful. And insofar as wisdom is the knowing, judging, and loving things rightly, and virtue is acting rightly based on what you know and love, they summarize the twin historic goals of a classical Christian education over the past 2,000 years, and that is wisdom and virtue. And given the power and importance of story in integrating knowledge, affections, and actions, and thus cultivating wisdom and virtue in our children, one could say that the central task of a classical Christian education is to capture your children's imagination with God's story of the purpose of their life and their education. We want the kids to not only know, but actually delight in the fact that they are not merely random atoms put together for a few decades of meaningless, purposeless existence of striving to get the best grades, to get to the best colleges, and to get the best jobs, and to make the most money, and to die with the most toys. We want them to not only know, but delight in the fact that they are actually sons and daughters of the risen King, who will only find their story meaningful when they find it in His story, that their hearts will be restless until they find their rest in God alone. We are re-narrating to them the meaning of being rich and hope that they will not only know but delight in the truth that the best way to be rich in life is to be rich in love, rich in wisdom, rich in faith, and rich in service, for then you are rich indeed. We are re-narrating the fact that they are blessed to be a blessing, not to be entitled, spoiled, self-serving elitists, and that God has given them gifts and talents to discover, develop, and deploy, not merely for their own delight, but also for the glory of God and the good of neighbor. That their education is meant for more than just making them good cogs and wheels and good worker bees and productive citizens somewhere, but that this is a privilege and an opportunity to cultivate their full humanity as those made in the image of God. We are re-narrating a story that says feeling alive is not necessarily having to always be stimulated by bigger and better and newer and faster things all the time, but that the glory of God is man fully alive, and being alive intellectually and emotionally, relationally, spiritually, and physically, this is a thrill like no other that actually brings glory to God. As you can see, it's just the tip of the iceberg, and it's a lot of re-narrating to do. And given our current cultural context, this means swimming upstream and fighting an uphill battle. And let's not kid ourselves, this is not an easy task. But it can only be done, perhaps imperfectly at best, in community, an intentional partnership with home, school, and church. And while schooling is just one piece of the puzzle, as a 15,000-hour decision, the amount of time your kids will spend at school from kindergarten through 12th grade, it's definitely an important piece. And while it's one thing to train the intellect mostly through formal schooling and such, it's a whole different ballgame to train the affections, because everything is competing for your children's affections. And everything you do, from how you spend your discretionary time and money, the books you read, the music you listen to, the movies you watch, the conversations you have, everything is training their affections for good or ill. And that's why, as a school, to help you in this effort to train our students' affections in addition to their intellects, we do our best to be as intentional as possible about the culture of the school, the wallpaper of life here. While it's certainly not perfect by any means, there is an intentionality to our school culture, which we believe is just as important as the curriculum and pedagogy we use. Since all these little things matter in training the affections and re-narrating a story of human flourishing for your children, you can see the importance of choosing our teachers, our living curriculum, with great care. Not only are they great teachers themselves who incarnate for the kids a love of God, a love of learning, and a love of students and for teaching, they are romancing your children's hearts to love that which is truly worth loving, to love the greatest teachers of all time and the great enduring ideas of all time. And they are introducing them to the great conversation. And while our teachers are consummate professionals, I think part of what makes them especially wonderful is that they have the heart of amateurs in the original Latin and French meaning of the word, which is they are people who do what they do for the love of it. You should see how excited they get about good lesson plan ideas and ideas that improve the school culture and community experience. Just being who they are helps to train the children's affections. So as you can see, we select our teachers with great care. Now, some people don't like the idea of affections being trained because we live in a day and an age where there's a bias towards the unaffected, the presumably authentic, and therefore untrained. But perhaps you can relate to this. Some of you have taught yourselves to be oenophiles and amateur sommeliers. Perhaps maybe you've learned to acquire a taste for fine cheese or fine scotch or cigars and good craft beer or things that aren't as easy to like as good chocolate. Just as we may seek to train our taste buds and palates for fine food and drink, and if not wine and scotch and cheese, we've at least probably trained our palate to like things better than McDonald's. Training the affections can be done, and actually must be done, as a part of our true education. True to the both-and nature of our school, here are some examples of how we train both the intellect and affections here at Cambridge. We are trying to train the intellect in reading by helping our students not only master the mechanics of decoding phonograms, but by simultaneously training their affections to enjoy and appreciate good books, and eventually great books, by being very selective about the kinds of books we read to them and have them read. Choosing books with compelling stories and beautiful language, strong similes, metaphors, and analogies, so that their ears will eventually be tuned to a beautiful turn of phrase, sonorous and mellifluous use of language, and they will notice when a story is not compelling, when the pictures and the language are not beautiful, and when they are. In terms of thinking skills, we train the intellect with formal and informal logic classes in 7th and 8th grades, and give students opportunities to use and hone their analytical skills in speech and debate class and across disciplines. But we simultaneously train the affections so that students begin to wield their newfound logic skills humbly, and so that they learn to actually seek and delight in clear thinking in every discipline. And the same goes for rhetoric. We are training the intellect to synthesize, complicate, and nuance their ideas as they generate them, and then to communicate them winsomely and persuasively in writing, in speech, and in images to particular audiences while being a very particular kind of person themselves. But we are also simultaneously training the affections so that they know that these newfound skills are to be wielded for noble ends, for the glory of God and the good of neighbor. In short, we train their intellects for excellence, but their affections for humility and godliness. And the real test of this training of affections will be to see someday how they choose to use their discretionary time and money, what they take delight in and spend their energies and their life on. For indeed, where your treasure is, there your heart is also. In closing, Cambridge and Classical Christian Education is all about formation of the rightly ordered intellect and rightly ordered affections by inviting students into a new story that links what they know with what they have come to love and therefore how they act. And as such, Cambridge is a place for centripetal gathering for the purpose of centrifugal sending. Indeed, our children are the messages that we will send to a time that we will not see, to a future that we will not know. And from the looks of it, it seems that future will be ever more complicated than our present. Even though these days with young children can seem long, the reality is that you'll blink a few times and somehow they'll be off to college. As they say, the days are long, but the years are short. As Proverbs says, they are the arrows in your quiver, and we hope and pray that by God's grace they will shoot straight and true when they leave our homes and our schools someday. But if we've done our jobs well in forming their intellect and their affections to be tuned to truth, goodness, and beauty during these early formative years, and God takes a hold of them in such a way as they become men and women after his own heart, imagine the impact that these students can have someday. Just imagine what God can do in and through them as they realize that all creation groans from the fall and things are not as they should be. And what is not what necessarily ought to be. And that having their imaginations captured by stories of kingdom-oriented desires and then acting on them for the glory of God and the good of neighbor is actually a delight to their own souls. Doesn't that excite you? Isn't that what you want for your kids? Isn't that what you pray for? Isn't that why you're here, to find a like-minded partner in a school that wants those same things for your children? Isn't this a vision of education worth investing in, sacrificing for, building together for the glory of God, the good of your children, as well as the good of our community, our nation, and our future? I hope so, because that is what has gotten me up in the morning for the past decade or so. And that's what drives every staff person and faculty member to pour so much of themselves into this endeavor as they do. I know that even in our 11th year, our story here at Cambridge is just beginning to unfold. But we trust that God, who is the Alpha and the Omega, who knows the end of the story from the beginning, that He has His hand upon the school and upon the school year and upon your children. So I encourage you to press on in faith in this story, knowing that He who began a good work here at Cambridge will be faithful to complete it, and that He who has been faithful in the past will continue to be faithful in the future, and that we serve a God who has sent manna that we did not know, led us to streams in the desert, and made a way where there seemed to be no way, and showed us time and time again that indeed all things are possible with God. Thank you for joining us tonight. We're so glad that you could make it, and we hope that you're only more excited to be a part of this community of faith and learning after tonight and after your time in your children's classrooms. Good night.